I'm told I should turn this light down, but I don't really know how. It doesn't seem to have a volume control, as it were. Okay, our next speaker is Merle Sprinson, and her topic, Now It Can Be Told, Uncovering the History of Little Wonder Records and Bubble Books. Merle earned her PhD from Harvard University in Sociology and Social Psychology while a National Science Foundation Fellow. She also holds a bachelor's degree in Sociology and Anthropology, summa cum laude, from Oberlin College. Merle has spent more than 25 years developing global business-to-business marketing and sales strategies for premier global corporations and consulting firms, as well as startups, while bringing special expertise in the business services sector on technology, e-commerce, and accounting. She has worked with media, publishing, and telecommunications companies seeking growth. Merle was an executive director at KPMG and was the first chief marketing officer of Sapient, an IT consulting firm. She also served in many global marketing roles at Accenture. She's been collecting Little Wonder records for more than 10 years and is known in some circles as Miss Little Wonder. Merle Sprinson.
Just getting the AV working here.
Camera, you're there. Bring it up to the screen, please. I keep a hand. Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, when you said bring it up to the screen?
Go full screen.
I went full screen.
Remember the function F8?
Sorry. Could you? I did F5, so it's full screen here.
Yep.
But I don't know how to put it up there.
We have to send it out to the projector.
Well, I don't know how to do that.
How were you doing that earlier?
It just did it automatically.
I don't see the icon on here. Start and restart it, I'll do it again by itself.
You mean just turn the computer off and
just
start it on
again?
Okay. Sorry. We'll get started in just a second here. So while this is doing this, I'm just going to start talking, and then we'll just figure out where we are as the time starts, as the computer gets itself together here. Okay, so imagine that the world in 1914. World War I is about to begin, or is beginning. It also turns out that the Panama Canal is just opening. Just trying to give you some historical context here. There is the very, very first scheduled airline flight. It happens between St. Petersburg and Tampa. Henry Ford introduces the assembly line. Charlie Chaplin debuts the tramp. And recorded music is controlled by Edison, Victor, and Columbia. And you're watching Windows 7. Ta-da! Okay, here we go. And then along come Little Wonder Records. So there's this monopoly that's being controlled by the majors, and then all of a sudden come Little Wonders. Well, most records at that time, and there's a little small typo here, but most records played for 2 to 3 minutes and were 10 inches big. Little Wonder Records played for a minute and a half to 2 minutes, but they were only 5.5 inches. Obviously, that 5.5 is on the wrong line. On most records, the performers are noted, so you can tell exactly who the artists were. But on Little Wonder Records, no performers were mentioned, or almost no performers were mentioned. Most of the records of the time that were recorded were in high quality, and users protected them in sleeves, or they came in sleeves. Little Wonder Records, the sound quality isn't particularly good, even on their best day. But most records cost 75 cents to a dollar, which is about $20 in today's money, and Little Wonder Records were priced only at 10 cents. The impact, though, was enormous for Little Wonder Records. They weren't sold through traditional retailers. Instead, they were sold through 5 and 10 cent stores and mail order catalogs. And millions and millions and millions of them were sold. 20 million at least in the first 10 months, when total industry production was probably 40 to 60 million for the entire year. Woolworths couldn't keep them in stock and almost threatened to remove them altogether, except for the very strong relationship between Watterson, who was distributing them, which we'll come to in a minute, and the top executives at Woolworths. You could say that it was one of the very, that Little Wonder Records were one of the very first disruptive technologies. Because of Little Wonder Records, at this point in time, recorded music was democratized. For the very first time, ordinary people, that is not the upper class, upper middle class, could afford recorded music. Whereas until then, most of the time, whenever they, or almost all of the time, when they were listening to music, it was being performed live in one way or another. Obviously, there was no radio, bands, performances, concerts. Suddenly, they could have music in their house. So what was this music? So I've brought some sound clips so that you could get a sense of the music that is being recorded on Little Wonder. Little Wonder happened from 1914 to 1923. So one of the first things, and they were recorded chronologically, so if you go up through the matrix numbers, what you watch is what's happening historically from 1914 to 1923. And clearly one of the most important events in that time period is World War I. So we'll listen first to some of the war clips. So we'll start with the first track.
It's a long way, but it's a very, it's a long way to go. It's a long way, but it's a very, to the sweetest girl I know. But I think it's eerie, farewell, let's explain. It's a long, long way to Tipperary.
Obviously a standard war song. The second one that we'll listen to is perhaps more interesting, new lyrics to an old tune.
Oh, the Yankees and the Tommies, they all talk the party boot, all talk the party boot, all talk the party boot. The Yankees and the Tommies, they all talk the party boot, they were kind of low. After the ticking bomb, over the trenches we go, and the stars and stripes will wave over Germany, wave over Germany, wave over Germany. The stars and stripes will wave over Germany, come and join the joy.
Obviously sung to the tune of My Old Gray Mare, which is in fact the title on the Little Wonder, so it's always a surprise when you think you're going to listen to Old Gray Mare, and in fact you're hearing a song about the Yanks and the commies. Okay, the next category, ethnic songs. Clear, huge wave of Irish immigration, so we'll listen to one of those.
My wild Irish rose, the sweetest flower that grows. You may search everywhere, but none can compare with my wild Irish rose.
Yiddish songs also make an appearance, or at least Yiddish related, all in English. There are no, to my knowledge, except for some opera, which we'll hear in a few minutes, no non-English songs, but Yiddish-like songs.
Have a look, see that Yiddish crowd. Give a look, see them talking loud. It must be a holiday of four, but everybody dressed up like a whore. There they go, in the cabaret. Now I know, why they feel so gay. There's something in that tune so grand, played by Max Pavlinsky's band.
And Hawaiian music favors quite prominently, features quite prominently in the Little Wonder repertoire, and we'll hear an example. I call the next category sound experiments because since it's early days of sound recording, as you all are aware, they're still trying to figure out what kinds of music and what kinds of sounds people, I mean, record well and people are interested in hearing. So here's some examples. The first is called Jolly Coppersmith, which you'll see for obvious reasons. Now, no company files survive that we've been able to find so far, and so it's not clear how many of which titles were actually manufactured, but I personally would bet that Jolly Coppersmith was the best selling of all the Little Wonder records. A friend of mine once said that she could retile her entire house with copies of number 22 Jolly Coppersmith. Moving along, we get another odd use of recorded music.
Revenue.
Little Wonder 906 is called U.S. Bugle Calls and goes through the standard repertoire of military life bugles. Next, we hear yet another. This, however, is not actually being performed by the creature that it sounds like, but instead by a human. That was number 1015, Bird Voices, in case you couldn't tell. Now I'm going to talk about some records that I call cross-genre. That is, there's a huge variety of kinds of repertoire. And so the first one is a minstrel, is a part of a minstrel show. Now, obviously, the whole record's only in a minute and a half. So what we're hearing is a piece of a piece of a piece. But nonetheless, you'll hear a little bit of a minstrel performance.
Keep your eye on the grand old flag. Uh-huh. And I've been keeping my eye on you, too. It seems that you go by the name of Johnson, and your wife goes by the name of Jackson. Now, will you kindly explain yourself?
With pleasure, my boy. You see, I haven't been acquainted with Julietta but 4 days when I married her, and I thought of how it would be safer for us to retain our maiden names until we see how the experiments turn out.
And you'll hear sound quality is not absolutely terrific. I mean, as you've noticed, is not terrific on all of these. It's startling to me, at any rate, that people would buy these records to listen to performances that are that indistinct and still find incredible value for themselves in those. Next is a tune by Wilbur Sweatman. some of the earliest recorded jazz. And next, please, is the last in this section. Then there's the whole category which you run across, of course, in whenever you're doing historical work, that the standards of today are not necessarily the standards of earlier times. And that is certainly reflected in the songs and in the lyrics of some of the songs that are recorded on Little Wonder. So we'll hear just two examples, the first of which you need to listen to carefully because you know this song, it's just you know different lyrics to this song.
In the winter, in the summer, don't we have fun? Times are warm and getting warmer, still we have fun. There's nothing purer, the rich get rich and the poor get children. In the meantime, in the green time, ain't we got fun?
Now you could say, well, that's just the recording on Little Wonder Records, except it isn't. I have the sheet music, and that's actually the original lyric. The rich get richer, the poor get children, and that's the way it is. The next one, we also know, slightly different tune, but certainly very different words. Enough said on that topic. Now we'll have some fun with artists. So almost no artists are labeled on Little Wonder Records. Prince Band is on some, but otherwise pretty much not very many. So they're done, the artist attributions are done purely by ear, with collectors who know who they're listening to doing the identification for us. So we'll just take a few examples, I'll play them, and then I'll tell you who they are. So you can play along first.
Gone are the days that I spent to wheel Carolina. She had the sunshine in her laughter, just like the state they named her after.
Al Jolson, probably the most famous of the Little Wonder Records, number 20. Next. The Farber Sisters. Next.
I need to cut my dinner down. I never even hesitate. I never frown. I cut my sugar. I cut my coal. But now they dug deep in my soul. I've got the blues. I've got the blues. I've got the alcoholic blues.
Billy Murray. Okay, next.
I love the net, Posey and the Wall. Like what all the net, down on a farm. Over and always found the thought of a clinging vine. The heart
kitchen where some rambler rolls his pine.
That was Frank Crummett. Next. Jean Green. Next.
Down in the old England, the sunshine they love, that's where the summer's gone. My hat's been all wrapped up in that land of magic charm, carry me back to Albany Farm.
Takers? Vernon Dahlhart. Jack Palmer attested to that one, so I'm fairly confident about the attribution. And the last one. California Ramblers. Very early California Ramblers. So you can see the huge variation that sits in these roughly 1,600 or so Little Wonder records. And so people could pretty much have their choice of musical styles, genres, types. And as I said, millions and millions were sold. But there's a huge question, which is, where did they come from? And how could they have existed? How could something sell millions and millions and millions when the copyrights were controlled, patents were controlled by Columbia, Victor, and Edison? So there was a mystery. So now imagine the year 1999. So we started off thinking about 1914 when they came out. Now it's 1999. So what's happening now? Well, the Euro is established. SpongeBob SquarePants debuts. Napster debuts. The Panama Canal is turned back to Panama. My collection of Little Wonder records begins in full force. And Tim Brooks, who's sitting here, publishes the very first Little Wonder discography. Now, those last two are pretty related to each other, because when I started to collect them, I didn't really understand their historical importance. I was just sort of collecting them because I thought they were cute, didn't take up a lot of space. I live in Manhattan. And they were reasonably inexpensive. But then when I read Tim's beginning history, I realized that they played this incredibly important role. Not very much was known about them. And so there was a chance to find out more. What we knew in 1999 was about the monopoly. We knew it was controlled by Henry Watterson, at least initially, distributed by him. There were about 1,300 recordings, and Watterson had been sued, at least initially successfully, by Emerson, but that was overturned on appeal. Then I start the history work. And a friend of mine said that, in fact, whenever there's a lawsuit, the court has to keep all the papers. So I said, well, you know, like what papers? And he said, well, the actual papers. I said, well, what do you mean? He said, well, like the depositions and the testimony and every single filing for that court action, especially if it was on appeal, everything would have been transcribed and brought before the appellate court. It has to exist. He said, where was the case tried? I said, well, actually, in New York, which is where I lived. He said, well, just go down there then. I said, well, like, where is there? He said, you know, the court building, like the one that's on Law and Order? He said, like, that one. So I went to that very building and went in, and there was a sign called information. So I went to the guy in the information desk and I said, this is what I'm trying to do. And I said, I call it making new friends, because he said, well, you know, you need the court number, the case number. And I said, well, you know, it's 1914, I don't really have it. And he said, well, go talk to my friend Bill. He's in the basement in this room, and he'll look it up for you. Tell him I sent you. So sure enough, I got the case number, went to the file room, gave him that paper. He said, well, come back in 3 or 4 days and we'll call you. I said, well, what will you have? He said, the file. Really? Yeah, really. So they called me. I went down and they handed me the original documents from the case between Watterson and Emerson, and it was all there. The actual contract between Watterson and Columbia, all of the details in that contract, plus all of the depositions, all of the testimony, all of the accounting, everything. Now, that's still not completely everything, as you'll see in a few minutes, but as a result of that, we now know a tremendous amount more. The first is that Emerson invented them while he was employed at Columbia and was looking for a way for Columbia to bring them out and thought that Watterson was the right person. Watterson, as you may know, was the president of a sheet music company called Watterson, Berlin, and Snyder. The Berlin is Irving. Watterson sold all of his sheet music through all of the 5/10 stores. He had massive distribution salespeople all over the country selling for him, and to put these records into his hand, he already had the relationships. Because of his connection with the sheet music, he then could cut deals with all of the song publishers, he being prominent among them. The terms of the contract were to be kept secret, and the contract specified that, which is why at the time no one knew for sure where the records came from. Watterson's accounting showed a roughly $72,000 loss, which is huge, except that $190,000 was being paid in royalties to his own companies. So Emerson was trying to sue for profits. There weren't any. One can claim that it's the first or a documented case of what you can do with financial accounting. And it shows fairly definitively that artists were, in fact, paid to record. There's some discussion about that. But at least some artists were paid something for their recordings. There's a mystery about paper labels not appearing in the very first Little Wonder Records, as you saw in the original slide. Some have black on black. That's because the contract stipulated that if Watterson wanted to have labels on the records, he'd have to pay, and he wasn't interested. So Columbia, though, was obligated to identify on the records what the performance was, and so they invented that black on black appearance. When, in date terms, it appears as if the label was turned back to Columbia, all of a sudden paper labels start showing up. There are now about 1,500 that we've identified. That information doesn't come from the company files, it comes from my own collection. Now that I'm known as a collector of Little Wonder Records, people start showing up and offering me their grandmother's Little Wonder collection that they've just stumbled upon, and so I've been able to consistently add new records to the list. And many, many more artists have been identified. Columbia expanded the franchise, manufactured the first book and record series, now known as Bubble Books, that were known then as Bubble Books. They also provided records for Rust Craft that were marketed as special little promotions. And at the very end of the history of Little Wonder, they manufactured personal records. We still don't know for sure, though, who all the artists are. We're working on that, and I think it will ultimately take company files to figure out who's performing on each of them. We don't know which records for sure were produced. I still find ones that no one knew existed before. And we don't know how many of each particular title were sold. And we don't know why it was that Watterson seemingly gave the contract for the distribution of the records back to Columbia. So there's still more mystery and still more things for me to find. Yeah, sure, there's a question way in the back. You're the way in the back.
Yeah, I just want to say, first of all, I disagree with the technical quality. I find the technical quality
Yeah. Well, I'm delighted to hear that. And some other people have recently commented on, at least on some of the performances, that in fact the orchestrations are among the very, very best recordings of those tunes, period. That they have greater flair and interest in the recording. So I completely agree, but I'm if you compare it to a beautiful diamond disc recording on the correct machine, there is way more extraneous noise, even on pristine records. There doesn't appear to be. The machine that's called a Little Wonder Phonograph appears to have originally been issued not to play Little Wonders because it was a vertical player. Later, apparently, in its life, it played both. That's about the closest as we have identified something that looks like that at least is named a Little Wonder player. There is a baby phonograph, which was advertised in its early days at the right price of an advertisement that Waterson came out with that said he was going to be issuing a phonograph. It's possible it was the baby, but we don't know for sure. No, there aren't any of those kind of as continued. No, there are some that are that continue a theme. So there might be popular airs 1, 2, 3, but it doesn't continue through like the way that there are in 78 sets.
Would he actually press these records? And if so, is that where the loss went? He had to pay more to Columbia to press the damn things than he could get for retail from.
Well, he paid Columbia 6 cents each. They were pressed. He paid 6 cents each, sold them for a dime.
So there's obviously a huge loss since there's a distributor involved.
Well, right. He made between a penny and 2/3 of a penny each on each record, but sold millions. So it does not appear that he lost money in this deal. One more question, or that's it?
One more.
Okay.
I just wondered, in your identification process, are you finding one-hit wonders in there?
Meaning?
Somebody that only recorded one thing and that was it?
If they only recorded one thing, we can't identify them. Because what we're doing to try to be as careful as possible is to play known recordings of that person against the recording on Little Wonder and seeing if they sound alike. I mean, compare signatures and all of that. We're not doing it that in a way that's that complicated. So unless we find company files, we can't identify one-hit wonders. And there very well may be some really interesting ones, but we can't find that yet. Thank you all.